Okay, so good morning. Today is February 18th, 2015, and we are here with Professor Robin Elliott, who's going to tell us about his life and work here at UBC. So welcome, Professor Elliott.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So let's start from the very beginning. What is your background?
So I was born here in Canada in 1948 to parents that had decided after the Second World War, they met and married in India, that they wanted to go to some place new and different to make their post-war lives. Ended up choosing Canada, I was one of the, I guess, first achievements for them when I arrived. I grew up in West Vancouver, and most of my schooling was in West Vancouver. I graduated in 1965 from West Van Senior Secondary. I would say that I enjoyed a pretty privileged childhood. My father stumbled around from various different, not very satisfying jobs. He started out actually up in Prince Rupert picking stones off fields, then tried his hand at being a post office employee. Then he went into real estate. He ended up in what we would now, I guess, call the financial world. It was called stockbroking in his day, and he ended up having a gift for it, did pretty well, and my two younger brothers and I profited from that. So we lived, I think, a very comfortable and privileged life. So not many hardships to look back on. We lived in a world that was, I guess, heavily British. West Vancouver in those days had a lot of people who had, like my parents, decided to make a new life for themselves in Canada and ended up in Vancouver and gravitated towards West Vancouver. So for my parents, I think it was a nice aspect of living there. And of course, it's a very attractive part of the city to live in too.
Yeah, great. So tell us, why did you choose to do law? How did you find out about law school and why did you make that choice?
Well, I did my undergraduate degree here at UBC in mathematics, and in particular in honors mathematics. And I mention that because in third and fourth year, much of the work that we math students were expected to do in that program was sort of in what's called in the imaginary field. And I had gone into math primarily because it suited the way my mind worked. I was somebody who had always enjoyed breaking problems down into their constituent parts and organizing those constituent parts in an intelligible sequence and then working my way through each of them in turn and so on. And when we were moved into the imaginary field, I really struggled. I had a lot of difficulty working comfortably and happily in that field. So I finished the degree, but knew that math was not going to be my ultimate calling. And so I thought what I would do is try my hand at economics, which seemed to me to maybe offer another outlet in which to indulge those same sort of analytical skills. But now in a world that had the potential at least for real applications. So I was accepted into the program, but I had to do a qualifying year. And I discovered during that qualifying year that there wasn't actually much difference between mathematics and economics. They were both rather unreal. The only difference that I found was that economists pretended that what they were doing had real-life applications. I wasn't sold on that. So I decided that was another dead end. I had some friends who had started law school. They told me that it was a field worth getting into. I had no background, family or otherwise, in terms of the legal profession, so I couldn't draw on anything there. It was really just those personal friendships that led me to think that maybe law would be the route to go. So I applied here, and in those days, it wasn't difficult to get in. I got in. It was the first year in which the LSAT was written. That was kind of interesting. I remember I was up in the Okanagan, had to drive down overnight, sat the thing. They didn't actually use the results as one of the measuring sticks when they were assessing applications. It was more to try and see whether there was a correlation between how you fared in the LSAT and how you then fared in law school. In any event, I came into law school a little apprehensive, but I would say after a couple of weeks, I knew that this was the world for me. I really, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was, in fact, quite a revelation, because I hadn't really anticipated this, found that those same analytical skills that I had developed as a youngster in high school and so on and so forth, that I'd indulged as a math student, as an economics student, were equally applicable in law. In fact, was a very good fit, but law now really did offer that possibility of real life application. So I knew after 2 weeks this was going to be my world.
Excellent. So can you tell us a bit more about your impressions of the law school itself?
In those days, I mean, the physical plant was dramatically different from the one in which we're now fortunate to work and study. We still had the old army huts. We did have a permanent building that had been constructed, I think it was in 1953. It was a very attractive building, but it was limited in terms of what it offered. So the highlight, without a doubt, in those days was the library, which looked north onto the water and over to the mountains and so on, really did take advantage of the view. It was predominantly male. The year that I started, and we were in those days a class of 240, I think there were 16 female students out of 240. And the prior year, if my memory serves me correctly, there had been only 8. And the following year, they went to 32. You might think there was some sort of rule in play that we would double, or the law school would double the number of women each year. It wasn't like that. It just happened that it went that way. So it was a very male-dominated environment. It was also a very Caucasian institution, so that the fairly large number of students that we have now who would have their roots somewhere in Asia, you just didn't see that at all. It wasn't that there weren't any, but they weren't a significant presence within the law school. We did have some First Nation students. We did have some Indigenous students. One in particular sticks in mind, Bill Wilson, who went on to become a leader within the Aboriginal movement, not only here in BC, but in Canada. But they were, again, pretty few and far between. So at least in terms of the demographic, it was a very different demographic than we would have now.
And what about the law school curriculum in those days? What kind of courses did they take?
Well, they weren't dramatically different in terms of what we were given in first year. So we had property, we had torts, we had contracts, we had constitutional law. We had a course called the Legal Institutions of Canadian Government, but if you sort of look behind the label at what was being studied, it wasn't markedly different from what our students now get in the first year public law course. The one significant difference, I guess, in terms of what we did study and that our first year students now don't study, was civil litigation. So in other words, you learn the kind of basic rules and procedures governing the litigation of civil disputes here in BC. It was a very dry, uninteresting course amongst what were, for me, as I say, some fascinating courses. There was no transnational law in those days. That's been a fairly recent addition. And then when you went into the upper years, I mean, there were quite a few required courses. So jurisprudence was required, evidence was required, and you had to do a second moot. So you had your first year moot, which students now still have, but you also had to do a second year moot. Fewer elective offerings than we would have now. The law has developed so much in the intervening 40 years. But we then would still have had the opportunity to study with downtowners who came out and gave of their time and expertise to create more practice-oriented courses. So you might think that the curriculum would now be dramatically different, and in some ways it obviously is, particularly in the upper years, but the first year curriculum was not that different then.
Great. So when did you graduate from law school, and what can you tell us about that time?
1973, and current students wouldn't like to hear this, but in 1973, if you wanted an articling position, you got one. It wasn't difficult in those days. I mean, we think now of sort of the small, medium, and large firms. Well, in those days, the largest firm, I think, in British Columbia would have had maybe 40 lawyers. So a different world in that sense. And in those days, you had no national law firms. So it wasn't as though if you, for example, as I did, went to article at Ladner Downs, you were now immediately associated with hundreds of lawyers from across Canada, because Ladner Downs became part of Borden, Ladner, Gervais. It was a fairly large, in those days, law firm, but it was very much Vancouver-based, BC-focused. So very different in that sense. I would say, you know, that in terms of some of the areas that people would be looking to develop practices in now, for example, in Aboriginal and treaty rights, that was really very much in its infancy. There were very few people litigating those kinds of cases, maybe Tom Berger and a handful of others. Maybe I'll note in that regard, just coincidentally, that the year that I graduated and started articles would have been the year in which Tom Berger won the Calder case in the Supreme Court of Canada. So that was not, and then obviously anything to do with information technology and so on and so forth, not an option in those days. And international law was a much, much less rich, less varied field than it is now.
So what was your plan after graduating from law school? What did you pursue?
Well, I never actually, much as I enjoyed the study of law, I never actually saw myself as a practicing lawyer. I wanted to, if I could, stay in the world, as I guess, of ideas. So I decided before I left law school that I was going to go on and do a graduate degree. But I did think I owed it to myself to article, see what the practice of law was like. Maybe I would find, in fact, it was more appealing than I had anticipated. So I did article, as I say, with Ladner Downs, but it was in the knowledge that at the end of that year I would be heading off to the University of London to do an LLM, and that was something that the firm knew as well. I told them that that was what I was planning to do. And I went off, had a wonderful year in London at the LSE, and came back a bit at sixes and sevens, wasn't really sure what I was going to do. I think probably my first choice of the options that I sort of set out for myself would have been to try and find employment with the sort of constitutional law division of either a provincial attorney's general office or the Department of Justice, and I sent applications out. I ended up not making much progress on that front, signed up as a junior associate with what was then Russell and Dumoulin, had a very enjoyable 7 or 8 months working with some of their senior litigators, Douglas McCabe Brown, prominent amongst them, on some constitutional cases, as it turned out. But I, as I was sort of starting out there, thought, you know, maybe teaching wouldn't be a bad thing. So maybe I'll give that a go. And so I just, out of the blue, phoned up one of my old professors, Peter Burns. Said, Peter, just finished off master's at the LSE. I'm thinking that maybe teaching might be a good option for me. Does the law school have any needs in constitutional law, which was the area I decided to focus on? He said, well, you know what, we might do. I'll get in touch with Bertie McLean. He was then the dean, and one of us will get back to you. Well, very soon thereafter, I got a call from Bertie McLean saying, yeah, why don't you come out and have lunch with Peter and me? So I did, and then I got an offer, and the move was made. The deal was sealed. When I think back to how sort of simple and straightforward that process was, in light of the process that our new hires have to go through now, a very long, drawn-out, rigorous, multifaceted process, I shake my head in disbelief. It's a very different world for them now than the world that I experienced way back in the, that was then 1975, 76.
So can you describe for us, do you remember any particular conversations that were, that would qualify as your job interview, so to speak? That
no, it was a very pleasant lunch with two people that I already come to know as professors here at UBC and felt comfortable with. And there really wasn't a whole lot of conversation about, you know, how I saw my career unfolding. It was more they confirmed they had a need in the field of constitutional law. I said that was great, and we maybe chatted a little bit about what other courses might I teach, but I don't think anything was finalized that lunch. So no, nothing particularly memorable about that. It was in the old faculty club. I'm sure the lunch was a perfectly good lunch, but no, nothing particularly memorable.
So how would you compare your law school experience here in Vancouver and in London?
Oh, well, maybe the first contrast that I would draw is that here, when I was a law student, we studied for the most part out of case books that our professors, either individually or maybe in small groups, put together for us. They were very much tailored to UBC's curriculum. And the cases and other readings were all heavily edited. And so long as you had the right case book, you sort of had everything that you needed to read in preparation for classes and to prepare for exams and so on. So when I got to the LSE, I was struck by the fact that all we were given was a reading list with case citations. And we had to go into the libraries there, more than one library, and actually track these books down. And I can remember that a number of the books that I was required to access, these would be old law reports and so on, were several feet above ground, and you used to have to take these ladders that would kind of roll along the floor, and then you'd latch them on up top, and it was, in some instances, a bit of a precarious climb up to the very top to reach the book that you required. All of which is to say that it was a much more physically demanding process getting access to the reading materials than the one that we had experienced here. It was a master's degree, so the classes were obviously much smaller, much heavier onus on the students to carry the load within the various classes. So some of the professors would basically expect individual students or perhaps pairs of students to carry a whole seminar for 2 or 3 hours. It was an exam-based LLM, so I did not write a thesis. And there was just the one exam at the very end. They were typically in a very different format than the exams that we had been accustomed to writing here at UBC, in the sense that you get 9 questions and you chose 4 out of those 9. So a great deal of choice. So that was new and different. And of course, the student body was very different because it was drawn from really all around the English-speaking world, rather than being as my first-year class and subsequent classes here at UBC, IE, and second and third year as well, obviously, very much British Columbia focused. We had a few students in those days from outside BC, but not that many. It was a very BC focused institution. Mm.
So now one of the big questions. So in your own view, what is different between UBC Law School now and when you started? What would be the major?
In terms of started teaching?
Yes.
Oh, there are a lot of differences. I'm going to start with the most obvious one, and I guess that's the building. Dramatically different and a dramatic improvement. Now, I should say that by the time I started teaching, we were no longer in huts here. So we had the old bunker building, a distinctly unappealing structure, if ever there was one. But it was new, so in that sense, similar to what we're experiencing now, but this is a far, far better structure in so many different ways than that one was. So the physical plant, definitely different. We've talked a little bit about curriculum. So the first year curriculum, not as different as one might think. Upper year curriculum, yes, different to reflect, I think, the way that the law has evolved in the intervening 40 years, a much broader array of optional offerings, and not just on the kind of practice side, but also on the more academic side. A bigger faculty complement for a smaller student body. I think it was about 1991-92, the law school under the leadership of then Dean Lynn Smith decided that it was going to move some of the faculty resources, if I can put it that way, into an enhanced graduate program at the expense of the LLB program. When I say at the expense of, just meant that we were going to be taking fewer students in. So we went from 240 LLB students down to a first year class of 180. So a not insignificant drop. I would say that the impact of that was felt more significantly on the graduate side, because we now were devoting obviously more faculty resources to that side, so we were taking in more LLM students, more PhD students, and so on. And that had, I'm going to say, I guess, an effect on the ethos of the place, in that when you move resources into a graduate program, you're starting now to focus more on the research side of things than you might have before, when the focus was very much on the teaching of LLB students. I think that the emphasis, the growing emphasis on research that resulted from that change, has become more and more pronounced over the course of the succeeding, say, 25 years. This faculty now, I think, has a much better, in every sense of the term, research profile than it would have had, say, way back when, which is not to say we didn't have outstanding scholars way back when, but I think the ethos of the place as an institution of higher learning has evolved in that way. Not, I would say, though, at the expense of high-quality teaching. I enjoyed high-quality teaching for the most part when I was a student here. I think, if anything, our students leave myself out of this, but I would say our students experience as well high quality teaching, maybe even higher quality teaching now. I know from my experience on the appointments committee, off and on over the years, more on than off over the last, say, 10 or 12, how important we took teaching ability in assessing the candidates that we looked at. And I'd like to think that the appointments that we ended up recommending to the dean, and most of those recommendations were acted upon, would be seen by students as having reflected that that ability as an important criterion in making those sorts of decisions. I think too that, you know, the faculty, in terms of the services that are provided to students, has evolved, and again in a very good way. We never had a career services office. Wouldn't have thought that was sort of part of what law schools were required to provide in those days. Well, I mentioned already, if you wanted an articling position, you basically had one for the asking back in the early 1970s, but we now have three people, and it's a very significant service, I think, that's provided to our students. I think the support within the law school that's provided to students now is significantly enhanced over what it was in the 1970s when I was both here as a student and started teaching.
And what was the workload like when you started teaching? Has that changed?
Well, it has. I mean, I don't know how far back this goes, but certainly 10 or I think maybe 15 years, new hires are given some teaching relief, so they don't have to teach a full load when they start out here. Well, in my day, I wanted very much to teach, and the faculty wanted me to teach the full first year course in constitutional law. The faculty also wanted me to teach two single term courses. One was called Agency and Partnership, which we don't have anymore. The other one was Equitable Remedies, which I think we still do have, neither of which I had any interest in teaching at all, but ended up obviously having to teach. I also wanted to teach out of interest a seminar in what was called Non-Western Legal Systems. And I was told that if I really wanted to do that, yes, I could do that, but it would be on top of all of the other things. So I not only did not get any teaching relief, I ended up having to teach more than the standard load. That's very different now. I think our new hires very much appreciate the fact that they only have to teach three courses rather than four. I mean, the flip side is that expectations in terms of publications were much lower in the 1970s than they are now. The pressures on our new hires and our younger colleagues more generally on the scholarship side, on the publication side, very, very significant. And you can see the evidence of that in terms of the amount of time and effort they devote to that side of things. So I think maybe slight reduction on the teaching side, but significantly enhanced expectations on the research side. Mm-hmm.
So what are, in general terms, some of the changes in your profession you have noticed throughout your career?
Changes in my profession. I mentioned a moment ago the fact that expectations on the research side are much enhanced in terms of our younger colleagues. I also mentioned a little while ago that the ethos of the institution has changed in terms of the importance attached generally to research. So I have obviously, I'd like to think, kind of evolved with that. Mm-hmm. I think my publication record, say, in the second half of my time here would be significantly greater than in the first half. So I think I've evolved along with the faculty in that regard. In terms of what happens in the classroom, obviously the subject matter, in a loose sense, has remained, at least for me, very similar, but with the advent of the Charter, for example, in 1982, Canadian constitutional law underwent a fundamental shift. It's a much richer area, and I suppose in that sense, a more demanding area to teach, but from the standpoint, I think, of both students and faculty members in that field, a more interesting area in which to teach. I think on the service side, I mean, that's an important part of being a legal academic. I think it's always been an important part. I would say that on that side, faculty members are probably working harder than they would have done when I first arrived. There are a lot of things that are constantly being re-examined and you know, adapted to the new world in which we live. And you do that through the standing committees, through ad hoc committees, and so on and so forth. So, for example, just to pull one out of the air, the dean decided the faculty should give some careful thought on a kind of global basis to the clinical offerings that we have here. So she constituted a small committee, of which I was a part, and it looked at those sorts of things and produced a report, and we hope that the recommendations within that report are now going to be acted upon. It looks as though perhaps some of the money that Peter Allard donated to the law school a short while ago will assist in allowing that to happen, but that's just one of a number of examples. Another one would be sort of deciding it was time to put in one place a governance document setting out the rules by which the faculty governs itself. Well, that requires a fair bit of work on the part of a group of people who were asked to take it on and so on. I know that one took a number of years to bear fruit, but that's borne fruit. So it's not that those sorts of things didn't go on way back in the 1970s, but there's more of that going on now, so expectations on faculty members have again been greater than they would have been back in the 1970s in that regard.
Great. So can you describe for us any notable colleagues you have had?
Gosh, yeah, I've had lots of notable colleagues. Where to start in that regard? Well, I'll maybe start with Ken Lissick, who assumed the deanship actually the year that I arrived. So I was hired when Bertie McLean was dean, but when I started teaching, Ken Lissick was dean. And I mentioned Ken because his field was constitutional law, and he served as something of a mentor for me. I think served as kind of an exemplar of what a very good constitutional law scholar could and should do as an academic. And one of the things that he did, and I, in a sense, I guess, followed him in this regard as well, possibly as in the kind of more traditionally academic regard, he did quite a bit of consulting work outside the law school, and that's something that I very much enjoyed doing, sometimes helping governments in constitutional cases, sometimes helping private law firms in constitutional cases. That's been very enriching. Well, he blazed the trail in that regard, showed that you could marry the two and that both could, I guess, profit each from the other. That is, the purely academic could profit from the practice side of things, as well as the practice side of things profiting from the more purely academic. Gosh, well, Peter Burns, I mentioned Peter. Peter succeeded Ken Lissick as dean, served as 9 years, and Peter was memorable for a number of reasons, but certainly in a purely selfish sense, for the support that that he showed me as I was sort of I guess, moving from very junior into the middle ranks and so on, and I very much appreciated that report. Lynn Smith, maybe what I'll do is just focus on the deans, because, I mean, I've known them all. Lynn Smith, I ended up actually serving as one of her associate deans for her first 3 years as dean. She was our first female dean. She was an innovator, there's no doubt. I already mentioned the reduction in the incoming class from 240 students to 180 students to free up more faculty resources for the graduate program. That was an initiative that she undertook. Joost Blom, I actually spent 3 years away from the faculty in the mid-1970s. I had a year sabbatical in the UK, and then I worked at Supreme Court of Canada for a couple of years. So I missed the end of Lynn's deanship, came back to Joost's deanship, and as with Peter, I would say I was fortunate in Joost to have a dean that very much supported me and what I was doing, and asked me to take on roles that I certainly very much enjoyed fulfilling, chairing or co-chairing the appointments committee for a number of years, and they were important years for us. I look around at some of the younger colleagues now, and I can remember presiding over their job interviews and so on. Feel very good about the choices that we made. By the way, one of the people is soon to be the new dean, Catherine Dauvergne. And then, of course, Marianne Babinski, she too, like Lynn, asked me to be an associate dean when she first arrived. That was a very rewarding experience. And I don't think I need to tell everybody that she's been a real innovator. I mean, the building, we've had significant changes, certainly to our curriculum over the years. I mean, not in terms of the core elements of it. I've talked a bit about that. That's certainly in terms of the first year, largely similar to the one that I would have experienced, but certainly at the margins and so on. She's had a lot to do with the enhancement on the research side. Her ability as a fundraiser is unparalleled, I think, probably in Canada's history in terms of law schools. All of those people were very, you know, significant, prominent people, and people I very much enjoy working with and under over the course of my career. I mean, beyond deans, gosh, we've had an awful lot of truly outstanding scholars. I mean, I think about, say, Michael Jackson and the work he did on prisoners' rights and Aboriginal law. People like Christine Boyle and the work that she did in the area of feminist legal studies and so on. Gosh, if I started onto that, I'd never stop. So maybe I'll just say that they would be just two of a number of examples I could point to, and I'd pick on them because they're contemporaries of mine, more or less.
And what about any memorable students or lawyers that you have taught or mentored?
Every single student that I've taught who's gone on to become a lawyer or something else has been a memorable student. So I wouldn't want to, I think, sort of highlight any particular individuals. There are lots of students that I've been fortunate enough to stay in touch with over the years, and they've, you know, in many cases become very distinguished members of the profession. You know, I've valued them all, so I don't know that I would want to set any of them out against all of the others as being particularly noteworthy.
Okay, fair enough. And in terms of the history of the law school, are there any individuals that you think we should interview to expand on our knowledge of the law school? Anybody you would recommend for us to interview for this project?
Well, I mean, I would hope that you would interview all of the deans who are still alive. George Curtis died, obviously, a number of years ago, as did Ken Lissick, but Bertie McLean is still hale and hearty, as is Peter Burns, Lynn Smith, Joseph Blom, obviously, who's still here, and Mary Ann. So I would certainly recommend that you interview them. I would think, going back to some of the people who were here when I started teaching, that someone like Leon Goetz would be worth having a chat with. Who else from those days? I mean, I guess, you know, somewhat more recent vintage, you could have a chat with some of the people who would have been appointed around about the same time that I was. So you could maybe have a chat with Dennis Pavlich, who's still on the faculty, Marilyn McCrimmon, now retired, Bob Reed, now retired, but they would all give you some good, I think, perspective on things. And then from the 1980s, you know, people like Isabel Grant and Joel Bakken and Bruce McDougall, all of whom are still around. And then into the 90s, you know, you've got people like Janine Benedette and others. So, long list.
So next year, 2016, you are retiring.
I am.
It will be 40 years since
it will
you
be.
Started the UBC Law. So anything about your tenure with UBC Law that you would like to reflect on that we perhaps haven't covered in these last questions?
I mean, I guess I would want it known that I feel very fortunate to have been able to work here for the years that I've been here, and yes, it's been a long time. I have thoroughly enjoyed the experience of being a law professor at this institution. I have loved the teaching. For me, the teaching was always the most rewarding part of the job. I think I would say I've come to enjoy the research side maybe more with the passing of time. I don't think I could ever say that I particularly enjoyed the service side. The service side, important, I've already made that point, but not the most stimulating of the various different aspects of this job. But it's not just sort of the component parts, it's the environment that I've been able to work in. And I mean, the colleagues with whom I've worked over the years, I can't imagine having had a better group of people. They're not only all outstandingly bright and competent, you know, so many of them are, you know, I would say amongst the very finest human beings that I have come across in the course of my time. They're warm, they're thoughtful, genuine, they're committed to the institution, but they, you know, have fulfilling family lives as well. And that's, I think, maybe something that bears emphasizing, that that being a university professor allows one a bit more flexibility over the way in which one leads one's life, how one allocates one's time over the course of a year, even a month or a week, than is possible in other fields. And I've very much, I think, appreciated that. So I would think maybe the one thing I would say is just how fortunate I feel to have had this job for as long as I've had it.
Well, on that positive note, thank you very much, Professor Elliott.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you.